And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span, 9 feet 3. And he had a helmet of brass upon his head, which means bronze, it's the wrong translation. And he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. That is 150 pounds. And he had greaves of brass upon his legs, target of brass between his shoulders, and the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighted 600 shekels of iron, and one bearing a shield went before him. And he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel, and said unto them, Why are ye come out to set battle in array? Am I not a Philistine, and ye the servants to Saul? Choose ye a man for you, and let him come down to me. If he be able to fight with me and to kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall ye be our servants and serve us. Now, how much better would have Goliath been off if instead of wearing his 150-pound armor of iron, he would have worn a 50-pound armor of aluminum heat-treatable alloy, 7076. Well, aluminum was not known then. Aluminum was not known for 2,000 more years. It was not known at the time of George Washington. And even at the time of Abraham Lincoln, it was produced in the size of a pinhead by chemists who were finally delighted to produce even this pinhead with a very great extent of work and labor and cost. Now, why is that so? Why did it take so long to tame aluminum and finally to bring it under control only in the last century? The reason is that aluminum has a much greater affinity to the oxide with which it comes in nature than, for instance, iron. If you take iron ore, as you find it, say, in northern Minnesota, and you put it into a blast furnace together with coke, then the FeO, the iron oxide, splits up in that the oxygen goes to the carbon, it unites chemically with the carbon, and this gives carbon oxide and carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, and the metallic iron is set free in the blast furnace, and it trickles down. It is not pure iron, it is iron which is contaminated with the carbon, over which it trickles down over the coke. And what comes out is called pig iron, which is a very hard and brittle stuff of no use technologically. So, in a second process, then, this carbon-containing pig iron, which is hard and brittle and also has a very sharp melting point, that is up to a certain temperature, when you heat it, it is solid, and then it suddenly becomes liquid. It does not go through this plastic stage, which is desirable for technological purposes, to roll it and to forge it and so on. So pig iron is completely useless. So in a second operation, then, you take this pig iron, heat it, and blow air through it, which contains oxygen, of course. Oxygen, and this oxygen then burns the carbon out of the carbon-containing iron, and this takes, well, 10, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and then you have a certain little residue of carbon in it, which is very accurately controlled. It goes down from, I don't know, 10%, 12%, down to, say, 0.5% or 0.6 or 0.7%. And what you then get is steel. That is iron with a small controlled amount of carbon. And this is, as you know, of course, can be rolled into railroad rails and into structural shapes and so on, and can be forged and so on and so on. So this is the process with which iron is produced, and many other metals. You take oxide or sulfide, and by means of carbon, then you get the constituents which form the compound broken down so that the pure metal is set free in the furnace. Now this has been tried, of course, by the chemists in the 18th century without success. You can mix aluminum oxide, which is produced by some chemical refining methods out of ordinary clay, or maybe out of bauxite, which is now the raw material from which aluminum is commercially produced, which is the red earth here, the stuff which is scooped out of the ground in open pit mines in Jamaica here in the American continent, and more recently, notably, in northern Australia, where vast deposits have been found, have been unearthed quite recently during the past 10, 15 years. So you take this alumina, which is then the white product, the white powder, gleamingly white powder, which is pure aluminum oxide, and you mix it with carbon, and absolutely nothing will happen. It will not split, and you don't get metallic aluminum. Now, it was only when the electrolytic processes were tried or invented or used, which could separate compounds in which the bonds between the elements were strong, that these bonds were split. If you take sodium chloride, ordinary salt, ordinary table salt, and you dissolve it in water, and you put electric current through it, then you can split it. You can split the sodium chloride into sodium and into chlorine. Chlorine gas, yellow gas, poisonous, used in industry as raw material for many processes, plastics and so on. And sodium, a white silvery metal, which oxidizes at once. If you make contact with water, it starts to burst into flame. It has now found, to a very limited degree, applications in electric engineering as conductor. I am not quite sure whether it's the right development or not, but those people who push it, of course, think it is the last word. I have still some conservative skepticism. So anyway, you can, by means of electricity, break down the sodium chloride into sodium and chlorine. Now, to do that with the aluminum oxide, with this white powder, it is necessary to find some liquid in which this stuff dissolves. And this was the trick. There were many people who experimented through the last century up to the second half of last century. And then two young chemists, both 23 years old, developed or invented the process of the aluminum reduction at the same time and simultaneously from each other. This was Erault in France, EH. E-R-A-U-L-T, and Hall in this country. Hall had just graduated from Oberlin College, and he fooled around in the back of his father's house in a tannery, as far as I remember, or maybe Erault's father had a tannery, it makes no difference. At any rate, both these fellows hit upon the process. Namely, this aluminum oxide dissolves in molten cryolite. Cryolite is in fluorine aluminum's compound, which of all places is found in nature only in Greenland. And of course, these chemists, they had innumerable bottles with all kinds of exotic stuff, and apparently they had cryolites there, and they heated that up to quite high temperatures. And lo and behold, in cryolite, this stuff dissolved, and when they put electric current then through the solution, then, to their greatest delight, liquid aluminum deposited at the bottom of the crucible. And the process finally was invented, which is the basis for the mass production of aluminum nowadays. And aluminum, as you may or may not know, is now the second metal, as far as man is concerned, in production. It comes right after iron. The next most copiously produced metal is aluminum. Now, I may tell you, before this breakthrough came by the invention of Hall and Erault, there were promising steps by chemists at the earlier part of last century which produced aluminum in quantities of a pinhead size. Ørsted and Wöhler, one German, one a Dane, and then De Ville in France, they all experimented and got, by some devious process, tiny little quantities of this metal, so they could say, right, it is a metal which we had suspected, it is a white metal, it is very ductile, it is very light, very charming, you see. And then, during the next decades, methods were developed which produced aluminum which was slightly less expensive. It was still more expensive than gold. And Napoleon III had a place setting on his table, on his imperial table, which was made of aluminum because it was so precious. But he was also sufficiently intelligent that he said, this metal is so light, you guys here, you chemists of mine, get busy that we can mass produce it, because I want to give it to my soldiers in their campaigns because of sea lightlessness. See, as I said, if Goliath had worn it, he would have won 50 pounds instead of 150 pounds. So he was 9 feet 3 tall. I mean, 150 pounds probably was not too much for him. But the difference in weight, of course, is striking. Okay, so nothing doing. At the time of Napoleon III, there's still aluminum was prohibitively high. And it was only when this electrolytic process was invented that the price dropped dramatically. And then the production started in various countries of the world. It is rather ironical and interesting that Mr. Hérault, he went to the largest chemical manufacturer in France, Pechiney, and offered them his invention. And the Pechiney people said, well, we have no use for this stuff. This metal is so soft. It's light, all right. What do we do with it? So they turned back to him, which was, of course, very, very short-sighted, but it is understandable. Now, Pechiney is the largest aluminum producer in France, and one of the very large producers of the world, because they have many subsidiaries all over the world. Here in this country, Hall, after 2 years of trying to peddle his ideas, and after he had it duly patented, they formed the Pittsburgh Reduction Company in Pittsburgh, which produced aluminum commercially, and out of this grew Alcor, which up to the end of World War II had an absolute monopoly. Now, this process then has been perfected, but is basically used. At the time of Hall and Hérault, they had a crucible which was heated extraneously with, I don't know, gas or something like that, and then they poured this cryolite in it and melted it, so that became liquid, and then they could dissolve the alumina and put electrodes in it, put current, direct current through it, and the aluminum, the metallic aluminum deposited at the bottom. This is aluminum oxide, and the oxygen again combined with the carbon of the electrodes, with the carbon electrodes gradually burned up, producing carbon oxide and carbon dioxide, and the metallic aluminum settled down at the bottom and was then just deciphered off. It's metallic aluminum looking like mercury, you see, liquid metal. But later on, it was found that it is not necessary to heat these crucibles, that the heat which is generated during this electrochemical process was sufficient to prevent the bars from freezing, from becoming solid. And as a consequence, the modern aluminum reduction plants have such, as we call them, pots. Better name is cells. And these cells look like I sketched it here on the blackboard. It is a long and comparatively narrow vat out of iron, which is lined with a fire, first of all, with a heat-resistant material, with a thermal material, so that the heat is not lost to the outside. And this then is lined with carbon blocks, with carbon. This I indicated, what color? So on the outside you have this heat insulation, and then you have all around here this yellow. We have this carbon line. Now this thing is a very shallow container, maybe so deep, but wide, all from the wall up to here, and as long as from this wall maybe to me. And then this is all lined with carbon, bottom and the side. And in this is now put this cryolite solution. And then you have large carbon electrodes, big things, this size, come down from the top. And each of these carbon electrodes is connected to the plus pole of your socks. So these are all in parallel. And the current then flows from the plus pole through the carbon electrodes through your cryolite bath into the lining. And from the lining it goes out the anode, the negative pole, and then it goes to the next cell. And there are a whole bunch of such cells connected in series because the voltage which is used to bring the current through the cell is very low, maybe 4 to 5 volts, say 5 volts. But the current is depends the amount of metallic aluminum that is produced. And in our meat plant, which is here in North of Spokane, it's around 60,000 amps, which this plant was built during the World War II and was enlarged later on. More modern plants have higher current, 80,000. 100,000, 120,000, that's about the maximum current I know of. So this vast current, which requires very heavy buses, goes through the thing and goes through the next cell and through the next cell. And if we have, say, 5 volts voltage drop on each cell, between plus and minus, 5 volt drop.
And we have 800 volt on our source, and 800 divided by 5 gives 160 cells. We have 160 cells connected in series. Physically, they look like this. There's one building here, which is called a pot room, and there are, as a matter of fact, there are two pot rooms side by side, and in each pot room is a whole series of cells. So I said 160 cells divided by 4 is, here are 40 pots. See, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 40 pots. Then you jump over, there are other 40 pots. Then you have another 40 pots, another 40 pots. So all total is 160 pots. And this is now connected to our power source, which is 800 volt. 800 volt. And this is, say, 60,000 amperes. Which gives 0.8 times 60. This is about 50,000 kilowatt. This is one pot line. Now, me has 8 of such pot lines. So 8 times 50 is, I can't figure that out. 8 times 5 is 400 megawatt. 400 megawatt. That's 400,000 kilowatt. 400 megawatt is the total power which a plant like me consumes. Now, such pot produces, there are slightly more than 1,000 pots in me. And me produces about 1,000,000 pounds per day, which is quite a bit. So 1,000,000 pounds divided by 1,000 is 1,000 pounds. Yeah, 1,000 pounds, that is about half a ton, is produced by each individual pot in 24 hours. So they sit there, and all what happens is that current goes through this thing and nothing else. If you go to the pot line in such an aluminum reduction plant, you think there will be fire and lightning and thunder and everything else. And the first impression is absolutely anticlimactic because nothing goes on. You go there and there sit these things, and every once in a while there's a fellow going around. He pushes the button, and then a whole amount of new alumina comes down from the ceiling. It is fed into the pot. And then there's another fellow, maybe he has a big vat. And from this, by means of this vat, he draws off the liquid aluminum from the bottom of these things. Now, these operations go on around the clock, day and night. And though you don't see many people around, inasmuch as the thing runs into three shifts, and inasmuch as there is, for instance, a subsidiary carbon plant, which produces these carbon electrodes, which are consumed, you see, their plant, like me, has about 1,500 people working. But they are dispersed over a wide area, and as always, you don't see very many of these guys hanging around.
Is any of the cryolite lost?
Very little. That's a good question. Yeah, there has to be some makeup, and cryolite is now manufactured synthetically, so one does not depend anymore on the supply of Greenland. As a matter of fact, this cryolite is lost because there are some fluor gases given off. And for that reason, there was in the initial stages of the game always the question of pollution. See, very, very early, the aluminum manufacturers were cognizant of that, and they spent millions, literally millions of dollars to catch these effluents, and they had scrubbers and so on, and the meat plant, just to show off, is all surrounded by beautiful flowers planted by the manufacturer, by Kaiser Aluminum, to show that the plants will not be damaged anymore. Now, I want to go a step back, because I want to trace the various steps in the aluminum production. The very beginning is the bauxite. This is this reddish material, may show it around. That's this reddish material which is found in enormous quantities in Jamaica, formerly British Jamaica, but now Independent Republic, in Central America. And there are ore-going ships which belong to the various aluminum manufacturers. This is Alcoa, Reynolds at Kaiser, these are the three big ones, and then there are quite a few newcomers, Harvey, Anaconda, and so on, which produce their own aluminum. They have all bauxite leases, which they exploit with big baggers. You see, the stuff is dug out, and then it is either put into seagoing ships and brought to this country to the alumina plants, which are large chemical plants which convert this brownish earth into this gleamingly white powder, which is pure aluminum oxide.
Now, 4 tons of bauxite produce 2 tons of aluminum oxide, and 2 tons of aluminum oxide produce 1 ton of metallic aluminum. So, to repeat, the ore comes by seagoing boats, which have much aluminum in their superstructure and so on, it's all big showy affair, goes to large chemical plants. Kaiserloom has 2 at the lower Mississippi, in Baton Rouge, capital of Louisiana, and in Gramercy, farther downstream, and you can see them for miles, enormous plants. And out of that comes then this white powder, and this white powder is shipped by railroad cars to the plant here in Mead, and other manufacturers who have their plants here in the Pacific Northwest get their alumina from their own alumina plants. Now, to ship it across the country is comparatively expensive by rail. And as a consequence, more recently, the bauxite deposits, these vast bauxite deposits in northern Australia, have been developed, and large plants have been built to scoop the stuff up. And also at the same location, or a few hundred miles farther south, at Deep Sea Harbor, there were large alumina plants. So the alumina is now produced close by the place where the raw material is. This was initially not done, I think, for strategic reasons, because I wanted at least you have the alumina plant within the continental limits of the country. If you cannot have the bauxite, which is a matter of nature, you see, all right, for God's sake, get the bauxite from Jamaica or get it from Australia, but at least we want to have our alumina plants within our own borders. Now, this philosophy has pretty much become obsolete at this time of intercontinental missiles and so on. So it is much more sensible now to have the alumina plant right built at the bauxite and then ship the refined stuff, namely the bauxite, namely the alumina, over in ore boats to, say, to the dock in Tacoma. And in Tacoma is an aluminum plant from Kaiser Aluminum, comparatively small one, though it is being enlarged now. And it goes then by rail the 300 miles here to Spokane, rather than going 1,500 miles from the lower Mississippi up here to Spokane. There are small deposits within this country which are being exploited, and there are vast deposits in USSR, which has its own aluminum industry, of course, in Hungary, and in many other countries of the world. In France, there was a town called Beaux, B-E-A-U-X, where bauxite was found first, and from this town the name bauxite has been developed. Well, the bauxite is this brownish stuff, 4 tons of this make 1 ton aluminum, and as the next step, I repeat that just for the sake of clarity, in chemical plants, the bauxite is converted into the alumina, into this white powder. How this is done, I can read you, but I think it's of no interest. It is the chemical process. And now comes the white alumina powder. This white alumina powder is then processed into the metallic liquid aluminum in the reduction plants, as I showed it here. Now we get out the quite pure, over 99% pure aluminum, and this looks like this. It is cast into what we call pigs. This is a model of a pig. The standard pig weighs 50 pounds, so you can easily handle it. We have also larger blocks, which are called sows, which weigh 500 pounds. I give that around. This is just a model of a pig, which is actually so long, weighs 50 pounds, so can be easily lifted because it's so large.
Do you understand we have to go
to
another meeting now?
Oh, well, right along.
Did you explain at the beginning, because I came in late, why does England call it aluminium and Canada calls it aluminium and we say aluminum? Did you explain that?
No, this is beyond my knowledge.
Beyond your knowledge.
Yeah. In German, you call it also aluminium.
And Germany is aluminium.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh. In France, it's aluminium. Yeah, but here it is called aluminum.
Okay. In the United States, we just cut corners.
Yes, yes, yes.
What do they do when they anodize?
Yeah, now you are fired. Will you stay here? You have to go too?
I have to go too.
Well, now I want to say this. You see, this raw aluminum is then processed by mixing it with various other metals, and you have a whole series of alloys. And these alloys are all tailor-made for specific applications. It is like if a lady makes cakes, the main ingredient is flour, But then you mix eggs or no eggs and certain spices, and you heat it at for certain lengths at certain temperatures, and you get a whole family of cakes which may differ in looks and taste and so texture and so on. The very same thing applies to aluminum at the next step. This raw aluminum is mixed with silicon or magnesium or manganese or copper and zinc or combination of these things, boron, God knows what. And then you get alloys, and these alloys have specific characteristics, and these alloys are then heated for certain times at certain temperatures, some longer, some shorter, some are quenched, that is, they are rapidly cooled, others are very slowly cooled, and as a consequence, you get a whole family of alloys which are all tailor-made for certain applications. For instance, you make alloys which are highly resistant to seawater. They are used for commercial fishing boats. You make alloys which are high strength. You use them for airplane wings. You have alloys which have high electrical conductivity. You use them for electrical conductors. You have alloys which resist the impact of missiles, fairly new development. They are used for armor plate, for tanks and armored vehicles. You have alloys which are weldable and can be formed and stand very low temperatures. They are used at for cryolytic, low temperature applications, as for instance storing liquid oxygen or liquid hydrogen for rockets, you see. So for different applications, different alloys have been developed. And this is a function of the Department of Metallurgical Research, which is a research branch of every major aluminum company. And then once you have that, you can go on and then you can put finishes on. Now here are three samples of aluminum which has been finished by such electrochemical process. This is not paint which is put on, but it is electrochemical conversion of the top layer. And this looks quite pleasing, and this is very much used for skyscrapers, for the lobbies of banks, post offices, courthouses, and so on, apartment houses. So that's an anodizing process, you see. But there are many other things you can do. You can plate it with chromium, which has been tried all the time now to make bumpers, because if the steel bumpers will be replaced by aluminum bumpers, the car will be lighter, and the car will start faster, it will stop faster, and it will burn less gasoline, so this is a great incentive to get away with steel and use aluminum. And the same is true, of course, aluminum engines. They have been used to quite some extent abroad and in this country, but the major metal is still cast iron. Well, as much as I can tell you when you leave, but at least you got some idea. Now, one final word. In the production of aluminum, a vast amount of electricity is used, enormous amount of electricity used. And that's the reason why the aluminum plants are concentrated here in the Pacific Northwest, where current and power is abundant and comparatively cheap, because our current here is produced by water power. So we have one third of the entire aluminum reduction plant of the United States is here in this area, in Washington and in Oregon. Okay? Any questions?
When they first had the aluminum plant in Spokane, it killed a lot of trees.
Yeah, because in the beginning they did not pay too much attention for the effect of this effluent, of this fluorine. Fluorine is a very poisonous gas. And then very soon they got wise and they spent millions of dollars of installing these scrubbers, as they are called, to catch these gases, these poisonous gases. And as I said before, in our plant in Mead, they have now flowers planted all around to show that they will live and grow and look nice. Though the trees farther around look very scrawny, because when the plant got into operation during the Second World War, when there was not much thought given to getting rid of these poisonous effluents, you see, they ruined the trees. The trees still look very, very scrawny from the initial times on, you see. Okay.
Oh, we're not leaving. Carry on.
Well, so we have these various alloys, which are tailor-made for the... Well, why don't you move over, then? I don't have to... And with these various alloys, then you can produce now an enormous range, an enormous variety of aluminum products. And the consumption of aluminum increases continuously. Now, from a technological point of view, we can discriminate a few things, and then I tell you about the application. One is plate and sheet. Plate are heavy gauge things, sheet are thinner gauge things, and foil is the thinnest gauge. Now what foil is, I don't have to explain to you. Reynolds, which is the second largest aluminum producer in this country and one of the largest in the world, started out in making cigarettes and very large tobacco plants in Virginia. And in order to get its own foil to wrap their cigarettes, they got into the aluminum business because they bought it from Alcoa. Alcoa asked an enormous price, and then Reynolds said one day, nothing doing, we make our own aluminum. So that's the way, that's true. Reynolds got into the aluminum business. So they make, of course, all kinds, the whole range of products, but foil was the chief objective they had initially. Now Kaiser, which is the third, Kaiser Aluminum, which is the third largest producer in the United States, one of the largest of the world, fourth largest of the world, got into this aluminum game because Kaiser then had the idea of building automobiles, and he wanted to use his own aluminum as much as aluminum as he could. Now this was one of the very few adventures which fizzled out. You see, the Kaiser car, you may remember that there were such cars built, but he was not able to get a breakthrough in the face of the big three of MG and Ford and American. So this business was dropped, but the aluminum business was flourishing and has expanded, and aluminum is now one of the major branches of the Kaiser Empire. Kaiser makes steel, Kaiser makes gypsum, cement. Kaiser Engineers is the largest contractor in the world, which builds dams, bridges, powerhouse, atomic plants, harbors, tunnels, and whatnot. You see, Kaiser Aluminum is a billion-dollar business now, and it is one of the 100 largest corporations in the United States. It is not even 20 years old. Quite amazing development. So, now, we have then plate, sheet, and foil. And these are examples of, now that's sheet. You see, that's neither a plate nor is it a foil. So that's sheet. That's sheet which is rolled. First hot rolled, then cold rolled. But we have many other alloys. This is a forging alloy. That's a forged part that is a connecting rod of an internal combustion engine. This is forged and extremely strong, which it has to be. That's a forging. And this is an extrusion. You take something like your toothpaste, which you extrude out of the tube. You squeeze it out. The same can be done with aluminum. You take a slug, usually a round billet, which is heated, and which special alloy, of course, for this specific purpose, tailor-made, tailor-developed, properly seasoned, properly heated, and this stuff comes out, and it comes out in very complicated shapes, if necessary. Now this here, I got this from a friend of mine who installed me four storm windows screens upstairs. And I went to him later on, I said, I'd like to have a little piece of extrusion which I can show around during his demonstration. So I got this to him. This piece is one piece, you see. Now think how complicated this would be if this would have to be put together out of different strips which would be soldered or welded or so. That comes out of the die head as one piece, and this is used for windows, you see. Some part is filled with insulation, some part interlocks with the other part, you see. I got that from the window manufacturer. So he uses
it. Window?
Huh?
Was it a thermopane window?
No, ordinary run-of-the-mill window in my house. No thermopane window. Just upstairs, my two guest rooms. That's an extrusion. So we have extrusions, we have forging. We have castings. Castings is a large technological field with which I had very little to do. Now, there is, of course, a vast amount of raw aluminum, primary aluminum produced, and there is also a fairly large amount of secondary aluminum, which is scrap aluminum. Aluminum things are scrap, no question about it. And there are companies which buy off aluminum scrap and remelt that. And this is secondary scrap, which is not as closely controlled as far as its constituents is concerned. And this is just very fine for casting. So many castings are made of aluminum housings of transmissions and lawnmowers and typewriters and God knows what. Vast amount of things where you wouldn't even think it's aluminum. Some of these parts are made of magnesium, which is still lighter. Now, for instance, my lawnmower has magnesium castings. So castings is an important application. And then an application in which I was specifically interested, as a matter of fact, I was asked to join Kaiserloon as an electrical engineer because of the electrical engineering application. It is used for electrical conductors. Now, historically, copper has always been used as the major material because copper has a very good electrical conductivity. It has historically used since electricity was harnessed, which was more than 100 years ago. But then one got wise to the fact that aluminum, though its conductivity is slightly less than that of copper, it is so much cheaper per pound that it is much more economical to use aluminum as an electrical conductor than copper. And all these lines which you will see here, particularly these so-called triplex lines, if you go out of the building, you can look up and you will see them probably for the first time in your life. They are made of aluminum. This is a very neat construction. We have one conductor which is spare, which has the dual function of messenger, that is, he carries the other two insulated conductor, and of neutral conductor. This is the conductor which is at ground potential, which is grounded. And the other two conductors are at high potential, that is, they carry the juice and they are insulated. And they are spiraled around the neutral messenger. The neutral messenger carries the other two. Now, in order to do that, this neutral messenger is not all aluminum, but it has a steel core. In this case, there is one steel wire, and there are six aluminum wires spiraled around it. That's what we call a 6-over-1 construction. And this type of conductor we call ACSR, aluminum conductor steel reinforced, a conductor which, I say that very proudly, was first developed in the United States in 1906 by Alcoa. It's now generally accepted over the world. When Germans got wise to that, they didn't want to take it. They said, ha, aluminum and steel, these are two metals, they don't go with each other. Steel has a different elongation, and how do we connect it? And so there was great reluctance to accept it. But finally, they got around. It is now all over the world the standard material for not only for distribution, that is low voltage stuff like this, but also for transmission lines, these lines which hang on these long insulator chains on these large towers, be it wood, be it steel. These are all, with small exceptions, I would say, all ACSR, aluminum conductor steel reinforced. We have not one steel wire, but we may have six around the one. We have a 7-strand steel core, and over that we have one layer of aluminum one way, second layer of aluminum the other way, sometimes even a third aluminum layer to get the necessary conductance for this thing. And these are large conductors, but they are very light, and they carry electricity. Now here is this triplex, and if you look closely, you will see the steel wire in the center. Here is another bare ACSR, which I made burn-off tests, and you see the aluminum was burned off, but the steel, which melts at higher temperatures, did not burn off. And you also see here a terminal which is attached to it. Now there's one problem. Aluminum covers itself at once with an invisible layer of oxide. Within a minute or two, you see, you have an extremely thin layer, atomic layer of oxide, which protects the metal underneath. The metal underneath stays bright and shiny, you see, and it gives a protection. But this oxide layer is an insulator, and as a consequence, in order to make good electrical contact, you have to remove it. You have to remove something which you can't see, so you don't know what you are doing unless you have a process. Now, what is done now is you put some grease over it, in which there are zinc particles embedded. And then you take such a log like this, and you compress it with a hydraulic press with high pressure. And this cuts then through the oxide layer, and the zinc establishes a beautiful contact. So here this sample shows two things. It shows a, as we say, a compression-connected terminal log made out of aluminum, and it shows here this 6-over-1 conductor in which the steel is still all right, but the aluminum has melted off because I made an artificial arc and wanted to see how long it takes, and so on and so on. This was part of my laboratory investigation. Here I have another sample, which is a welding cable, and it shows, which has to be flexible. The man who welds, like Terry, you see, if he has the electrode, you see the cable which is attached to his electrode must be flexible, otherwise he tires his arm if he tries to bend a stiff solid wire. This is quite out of the question. So these welding cables are specially designed to be ultra flexible. And here, such an aluminum welding cable, it's a vast number of very fine strands, and you can bend this thing and you will see it is really flexible. Now, as far as the end users are concerned, the major consumer of aluminum goods is the building industry. Aluminum goes now not only into windows, as you know, and doors and storm doors. It goes into many structural parts in houses. It goes into trailers, I would say without exception. Trailers have aluminum extrusions, like this thing I showed here, that is these vertical posts are extruded with slots, so then the plates fit right into the slots, if you look at these constructions. And the plates, of course, are corrugated to get greater strength and so on. Very fine, high-developed technology. This is, incidentally, something in which the aluminum producers are not involved. The aluminum producers sell plate to the airplane manufacturers, sheet to the builders of trucks and trailers and subway cars and railroad cars and boats, pleasure boats, commercial boats, fishing boats, and so on. But they do not build these things themselves. So Kaiser Aluminum has about 5,000 customers which all buy aluminum and then fabricate end products, the ice cube trays in the refrigerator. And there are innumerable applications which you wouldn't think of and which I certainly even don't know at this moment myself. Foil, of course, not only to wrap cigarettes in, but for TV trays in technology which did not exist before TV came. When I moved to Spokane in 1952, there was no TV in Spokane, so there was no need for TV trays, you see. I only want to show you how recent these developments are. There was TV in New York, of course, but not yet in Spokane. It just came in 1953, much to my regret. And so TV trays is today a multi-million dollar industry. Kaiser Aluminum has several plants, one in the west and I think one in the east, which makes nothing but stamps these TV trays for Swanson and for these people. Then cans, you see, it started out with cans, with quart cans for oil, for cars. It has now invaded the field of beer and citrus fruits, grapefruit juice, orange juice and so on. Fierce competition to steel, which always had the field steel counteracted by rolling thinner gauges, the thin steel as it's called, and fancy processes. Then came the top, which can be torn off, you know, this thing, major technological development that you don't have to run around with can openers anymore. Small things, but things which have to be multiplied by million and by many millions, you see, because of this large consumption. So there are plants which are either built by the aluminum producers, which build their own can plants right in Florida, so that the packers can buy it there. But there are also very large packing houses, which beer houses, which have associated aluminum can manufacturing plants in St. Louis and so on. So this is all as far as plate and particularly sheet is concerned. Plate are the heavier things, they go to the airplane industry, and this was the reason why the aluminum industry came to the Northwest. In the Second World War, you see, these plants were built with great speed to produce aluminum for Boeing and for Lockheed and the other plants here on the West Coast. Extrusions, that's the next field, which I just I showed around this one extrusion here, and I said not only for windows and not only for doors, but for such items like cars and trucks and trailers, you see. They are used in conjunction with plate. And if you are fancy, if you are very fancy, for instance, if you build the lobby of a very representative bank, First National Bank somewhere, you see, then you have to be sure, and the aluminum sheet is color anodized. It has one of these nice, distinctive, restrained, golden or brownish colors. You have to be sure that the extrusion has the same color, and that during the years, if there's any fading, there's very little fading, but there's some fading, that the plate, the sheet, fades at the same rate as the extrusion, that after 20 years, the extrusion are not lighter or darker than the sheet. That these are typical questions for the finishing department within the metallurgical department. I have friends and colleagues who work specifically on these things, and they made accelerated tests with artificial sunlight, you see, to accelerate the fading and to be sure that extrusion can be so processed that they fade just at the same rate as the sheet. You see, and I just gave you some glimpse of what we guys are doing. You
is
see?
That what the aluminum siding is made of?
Yes, yes. But sidings may be painted. I would say the sidings which you buy are not anodized, which would be too expensive, too extravagant. They are painted. And then you have aluminum nails to prevent any rusting, you see, and of course all through aluminum. These sheets are interlocking, you see, so one snaps into place to the next. They're very nice technological developments all during the last 10, 20 years. Roofing, you see, when you go here to the northwest and also to Tennessee, where there is large aluminum industry because there is cheap water power, you'll find many houses, farmhouses, chicken coops, and barns which are aluminum roofed, you see. Aluminum roofing has two characteristics which I'm sure you will not think of. Because it has a bright surface, it reflects the sunlight, it reflects the heat from the sun, so in summertime the building is much cooler than if you didn't have that. But in wintertime, the same aluminum surface reflects the heat which is generated inside from your furnace and prevents the heat from going out. See, that's very funny. So if you roof it with aluminum, you have the double advantage to keep the house cool in summer and warm in winter. And that's a fact. I mean, don't tell you stories. Now forgings. I showed you this little thing here from an internal combustion engine. The very largest forgings which are produced are the landing struts of these big, very big jet planes. I don't know how the forging for the 747, how large it is, how many thousand pounds it will weigh, but these parts get an enormous beating if such plane sets down on the landing strip, and if the pilot, for some reason, which can very well be, doesn't bring it down very smooth, but a little harder and it bumps. The stress which such part has to take is absolutely enormous. The parts have to be light, but still extremely strong, and forging is then the method with which these parts are produced. And I mentioned castings, which are being used, for very many applications, and right now, I would say routinely in automobiles for such items as the gear casings. The aluminum engine has been used, but has not been universally introduced. The cast iron engine is considerably less expensive, but it is very much heavier. So if you want to have a very high quality car, which is starting very fast and can stop very fast and which uses less gasoline, you may very well be willing to pay a few hundred dollars more initially for an aluminum engine. Now, there are certain cars which have been made with aluminum engine, but the breakthrough has not yet completely occurred. And I can assure you that the automotive salesman of the large aluminum manufacturers continuously lobbies the automobile industry, because each pound of aluminum they can palm off to the motor industry has to be multiplied by 10 million, you see. So this is a very attractive idea to sell aluminum to the automobile manufacturing industry. There have been all kinds of attempts made to be sure that the aluminum internal combustion engine will not wear out by, for instance, chromium plating the cylinders on the inside. Now, that's quite an expensive thing. Another solution which has been used commercially is to put a cast iron sleeve inside. That's the ALFIN process, that you take an aluminum casting, but then you have a four-cylinder engine. You take four cylinders out of cast iron, and you insert that, so then the piston moves against the cast iron, which then is the accepted way of doing it anywhere. Durable goods, here I said, refrigerators, furniture, typewriter, vacuum cleaner, lawnmower. Consumer goods, TV trays, foils, and laminations. I didn't mention laminations. It is quite an interesting field that you can have, for instance, a foamed plastic. Urea plastic, and you foam it, and then you put an aluminum foil on each side. You see, this is a very good heat insulator, and it is extremely light, so this can be used between houses. You have, for instance, aluminum foil backed glass wool which you put on your attic. I have that in my house, you see. So there's where aluminum foil comes in too. Now many applications of which I know very little are used in, quote, defense, that is for war work. Probably tremendous amounts, not only for airplanes, which we know, but also as an aluminum armor. Historically, of course, steel was always the armoring material. But then the question was raised, is it possible to develop aluminum alloys which could be used as armor plate? Aluminum is so much lighter. If we could develop, for instance, armored cars, which are armored with aluminum, and where the armor has the same resistance to penetration as steel, such vehicle could be dropped from an airplane by parachute, you see, and drive off. Now, can this be done? And of course, there were a vast set of standard specifications by which these aluminum alloys, these ballistic alloys, were tested. And none of these tests was really truly representative of the impact to which these alloys were subjected when shot at. So finally, the aluminum manufacturers, with Kaiser Aluminum in the lead in this case, built their own shooting galleries. That is, we have right here in Spokane, we have a building from which projectiles are shot into aluminum armor plate with different guns, different projectiles, and very sophisticated equipment to determine the speed of the projectile, you see, with electronic means to shoot through two screens of paper, you see, and so you trigger two electronic circuits and you know it takes so and so much thousandth of a second, and then you determine the speed of the missile. And so you determine the impact. And in this way, empirically, by really shooting in this alloy, you can find out whether it will withstand the impact of a gun. Now, it was found to, as a painful surprise, that certain alloys which beautifully withstand the impact of the missile from the side where the missile enters the armor failed in that on the opposite side, that is on the inside of the armored car or inside of the tank or whatever it was, a piece broke loose. And this fragment then, which came loose, flew through the inside, cutting off the heads of those people inside, you see. So that's not the idea, you see. The missile itself was stopped on the outside, but on the inside, a part broke off, you see, and was, so to say, a secondary induced missile. So, of course, this was only found out by these actual shooting tests. So this is now an accepted practice to develop new alloys which have this ballistic characteristics. These alloys must be weldable because you want no rivets. Rivets are weak points. If a missile hits a rivet, this wouldn't be so good, you see. So it must be all welded all around. These alloys are now available. These vehicles are manufactured in large quantities. It's good business. And these vehicles can be dropped by parachute from a large plane and drive off. So that's something too. But this is the only thing I know about the, quote, defense application. There may be many, many more military applications in addition to airplanes. Now, few words about the aluminum plants we have here in our area. We have this vast amount of hydroelectric power, about which I will talk tomorrow. And this was a major reason that the aluminum industry moved here into the Pacific Northwest. Alcoa, which is always the largest and the oldest company, which had a monopoly until the end of the Second World War, when first Reynolds and then Kaiser came into the business. Alcoa has two reduction plants, one in Vancouver, which has produces 100,000 tons, and in Wenatchee, a more recent plant, which you may have seen, which produced 175,000 tons. Reynolds, the second largest producer, has two plants, Longview at the Columbia, which produces 70,000 tons, and Troutdale, also on the Columbia, in Oregon, but right on the south bank of the Columbia, which produces 100,000 tons. Kaiser Aluminum has two plants, Mead, which produces 206,000 tons, very large plant, that is it produces 1 million pounds or 500 tons a day. So you multiply that and you come. And Tacoma had 40,000 and this has now 80,000. And Anaconda has a plant in Columbia Falls in Montana, a little bit farther east, getting its power from Hungry Horse. Harvey came fairly late into this business, has a plant of 88,000 at the Dalles, where there is a big power plant. And Intalco Aluminum, the latest one, has a plant in Bellingham, near Bellingham, which produce 152,000 tons, not pounds, tons. Each ton is 2,000 pounds. So this all adds to more than 1 million ton or 2 billion pound a year, only here in the Pacific Northwest. And this is about one third of the entire production of the United States. There are other plants. I mentioned before there are plants in Tennessee where there's water power too. The Tennessee River has been harnessed, including its tributary, though there is a sizable amount of aluminum industry there too. There are large plants down in Texas and Louisiana which are based on natural gas. Alcoa has a big plant there, Kaiser has a big plant there, very big plant in right outside of New Orleans, Chalmette. And more recently, one has built plants which are based on coal. Historically, the production of electricity from coal was more expensive than production of electricity by water power or by natural gas. But now technology has advanced to the point that coal-produced electricity can compete. And for that reason, there are several modern plants built on the Ohio River, where the coal comes right out of the ground. There's the power plant, there's the aluminum reduction plant. It's all at one place, you see. Reduction plant and even the rolling mill. Now, Ravenswood in West Virginia is a big combination of reduction plant and rolling and foil plant of Kaiser, very nice plant. And it gets its power from a power plant which is just a few miles away, which is based on natural coal. This power plant is right at the mine mouth, so that's all one large complex. The power plant does not belong to Kaiser. It belongs to the Ohio Power Company. But Kaiser gets the energy just a few miles to its reduction plant, and from the reduction plant it goes right into the plate and sheet mill and foil mill. And the advantage is there that you are within a radius of 500 miles of the consumers. Most of the industry, of course, is located in the East and in the Midwest. And this was a drawback and is a drawback in post-war years for the aluminum industry located in the Northwest. It was located in the Northwest, A, because we had cheap power. At that time it was cheap, water power. It is still cheap, but now we have this cheap power in the East too. And number two, because it was supposed to supply the aluminum using airplane industry at the West Coast. But now in peacetime, while of course the airplane industry is still supplied, there is a great amount of semi-finished products going east. And this means it has to go clear through the entire continent. And this is expensive. For that reason, these plants here in the Northwest have to do everything to be competitive with the more recent and more modern plants which have been built on the Ohio and along this eastern part of the United States. Well, I think that's about all I have to say at the moment. I'm open to questions. A small but distinctive audience. So
I think one of the greatest uses that I've found for aluminum that helped me out a lot is this tubing for pack frames. You know, it used to be made out of wood, your pack frame that you carry on your back.
Oh, yes.
And as tubing now, aluminum yes. tubing has cut that down so your pack frame and all the rigging weighs about yes. 2.5 pounds.
It's lightened your load.
Yeah. I appreciate that very much.
I forgot to tell you something, which may be of some interest. The aluminum originally, when it was found and when it was used, was a very ductile metal. It was always light. It is one of the lightest metals. But it was ductile, and this had the consequence that you could use it for Boy Scout canteens and for a number of other applications, but it was not usable as a structural material. And this persisted until 1906, not long ago, as far as I'm concerned. And in 1906, a German fellow by the name of Wilm, W-I-L-M, developed what is called the heat-treatable process. By a certain metallurgical treatment of aluminum alloy, he was able to produce alloys of strengths approaching and now equaling the strengths of steel. And with this invention, which did not bring him a penny except the unending patent litigation, heartbreak, bickerings, what goes with such inventions, you see? Now posthumously he is hailed as one of the outstanding pioneers. But during his lifetime, this was all frustration. As a consequence of this invention, the aluminum suddenly moved from a material of very limited application into one which had a very, very, very large field of application. Completely new fields were opened up. And the first application of these high-strength heat-treatable alloy was the structural framework of the first Zeppelins. The first airships lighter than air had an aluminum structure. This aluminum structure was built of what was then called Dur-Aluminium, it was called, it was in Germany, you see, with the I. So this was a high-strength aluminum alloy, and from that time on, these high-strength aluminum alloys are an indispensable part in the aluminum technology. It is not necessary to have a high-strength alloy if you have a TV tray and you just eat something and don't look at what it is, and this thing can be comparatively soft. But if you have an airplane wing, it would be utterly unthinkable to have that from ordinary pure aluminum. So the invention of Wilm in 1906 opened up an entire new chapter for the aluminum technology.
Do you think they'll ever start to reuse the aluminum?
It is being done. I said that the secondary aluminum industry collects aluminum scrap and remelts it, and this remelted aluminum is being used chiefly for castings, in which it is not so critical to control the alloy composition. You use all the scrap here in the kitchen and you use it and to feed it to us during coffee time, you see. That's secondary alloy, you see. That's not so critical. For your breakfast you get the fine thing, but then it is worked over, you see. Don't mind this somewhat. Yeah, okay, you're very welcome. And tomorrow I want to talk about electric power in the Pacific Northwest, if anybody's interested in that. And the day afterwards I want to talk about the fundamentals of mono and stereo as far as recording is concerned, because this might be really an intriguing question. How is it possible to have one pickup and with this one pickup to get out of the record two entirely different channels so you hear the sound binaurally, that is with your two ears? This is a question that intrigued me and which I try to present in a popular way, which is always a challenge. To present it in technological terms is very easy, but to present it to a general audience, this requires a little bit more thought. Okay, any questions about aluminum?
An aluminum wand on my vacuum cleaner, and when I
use an aluminum what?
Wand on my vacuum cleaner.
What is a wand?
Well, it's hollow. A big long tube.
Oh, all right, all right.
And, you fasten the brush on the
hand. Yeah, yeah.
And when I use it, my hands get all black. Is this oxide or something coming off, or what is that?
It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. If this thing is anodized, then it has this coating, and this protects it. Possibly quite cheap, or maybe you have fooled around with steel wool and so on and get it really nice and shiny, you see.
Could something on my hands, like the sweat or something, wear it off?
It is certainly harmless.
It's very old.
It is harmless. It doesn't do you any harm. You don't get any eczema, and aluminum is not poisonous, you see. Competition once, many years ago, spread vicious rumors that you cannot use aluminum pots because you poison yourself. The aluminum industry spent vast amount of monies of disproving that. It's not poisonous at all.
Aluminum depends on your sink that makes it black.
Yeah. Now, I have worked in the aluminum industry, which doesn't mean that I am blind to the fact that there are other metals. If you have a stainless steel sink, it might be something very nice, you see.
This one is the grounded, twisted one.
This is the bare one, is the grounded one. Yeah, it's grounded one, and at the same time, it carries the other two. You see, it has the dual function of neutral and messenger. We call it neutral messenger. And that's accepted way of bringing now overhead power from a pole into your house. Where I live in Spokane, we have our power line going in the alley. That is, we don't even have an alley. We have just a line, property line, and there are some poles. And from the lines which go then parallel to the street, they are at right angles, then these what we call service drops going into the house, which has a nice feature that the street is completely free of poles and completely free of unsightly wiring, you see. We have just trees in the street. And the service are brought in from the back. And such a thing which goes right to my house, I do not consider objectionable. Particularly if you have natural trees there everywhere.
When you spoke of castings and forgings, I'm not sure I know what you mean now. Castings are a pour.
Well, listen, don't feel apologetic. Of course, I don't speak here to metallurgists. A casting is a mold into which you pour something liquid. All right. Yes. A mold is a part which is solidified, but hot and still malleable, you see, pliable. And then you either have hammers which hammer it, like in the old forge, or you have a hydraulic press which squeezes it together with variegate force.